Does it just go on like that, or does it like does the thump 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 come in?
Do you not know what that's from?
I do not.
That's from Romeo plus
Juliet. Oh, of course it is. That yes, now that you mentioned yeah. it, yes. I always remember When Doves Cry from that.
Well, yeah.
But okay, I forget this about too. That. So this is
that's,
a podcast.
Hang on now. That is, I play that for two reasons. You are listening to Linoleum Knife. What is it, Alonzo? What is this podcast?
It's a podcast about movies.
Of the cinema.
That's right.
This
due,
was...
Due cinema.
This cassette was sent to us by an awesome listener, Dinah Moxie.
She has written in before.
I know her real name, but she goes by Dinah Moxie when she signs things to... Sends things to folks.
That's right.
She made us a cassette. A mixtape.
An actual mixtape.
And mailed it to us. And it's so awesome. I don't know.
Can you turn up my headphones a little bit?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm going to listen to this bit by bit. Because it looks like it's all media related, movie related, TV related stuff. Everything.
Now, when you say you're going to listen to it bit by bit, it doesn't mean that the Fletch theme is on this tape. Or is it?
I don't know what you're talking about.
The Stephanie Mills song.
Oh, we're back to that. Are we? Have you ever heard this song by this artist? No. Oh, it was on the Blah Blah soundtrack. Well, was it ever on an album? Was it ever a single released to radio in 1980, whatever? No, it was just on the Fletch soundtrack,
it was the
Running Scared soundtrack, or the Humps soundtrack, or
Club Paradise.
Turner and Hooch soundtrack. How would I know that? How would I know that one song that was released on the soundtrack?
For one thing, the Stephanie Mills song was released as a single. Mm-hmm. I have played it around you before.
Have you?
And you will recall at the end of Kevin Smith's Cop Out, when they play that song, I like had a conniption in the theater.
Okay, I don't remember.
You don't remember this? Okay. I had a full-on nerdgasm over that one.
Okay. Well, great. I don't know that
song. I won't be judged by you.
Too late. Too late, you have been judged.
Maybe Xanthor will do a cover, and then
perhaps,
you know what it is.
Perhaps Xanthor will. Someone just said on Facebook this past week that Xanthor is now the official Linoleum Knife inside joke, even though it didn't come up as an anything until last 2 weeks ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. That's how inside jokes happen.
That's, yes. Anyway, thank you for this really great gift of a mixtape.
And it's one of those really amazing cassettes that's, you know, yellow and pink and you
know. No, it's not.
Yeah, it is. Oh, well, the case was, I thought.
No, the case is just handwritten.
Okay, she used yellow paper. I mentally went to, remember those old Memorex cassettes?
Yes, the 80s ones.
Yes.
With the little... That had new wavy graphics.
Yeah,
on
they were yes. they were colored like the Stu Studio line.
Yes,
I mentally created that in my mind because her track listings are on this sort of because
you're mental
post-it paper
so
with
you
pink
mentally
ink
created
on it.
It.
I can create things with my mind. It's called imagination.
So we are. I play that also because of Romeo and Juliet that opened this weekend.
Oh, right.
That
which
neither of
us have
seen.
I'm
going to go see it pretty much immediately after we do the thing that we're going to do today, which is going to be cut short
right.
Today. Today's a short podcast. You don't even get an hour out of us today. We're going to the opera.
fancy
not
us.
Not just any opera. We're going to the 5-hour Einstein on the Beach today. Woo. Yeah. And that's going to be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But we're getting out of here very quickly as soon as we finish talking about these movies.
Now, I was on the B-Movies podcast this week, which if you want a long show that I am on, you could go listen to that one, because we did all three of us did a top 10 list of slasher movies and talked about new
films.
I know
it was long. It took you forever to get out of there, and you didn't leave when
you
were supposed
to.
I didn't
go to the grocery
store and get the things I needed.
Sorry again. Anyway, but Whitney saw the new Romeo and Juliet, and apparently it's Romeo and Juliet by William Shakespeare, with additional dialogue by
Julian Fellowes. Right. He Downton Abbey's it.
Yeah, I thought adapted meant, you know, maybe he, the usual trims that happen to a Shakespeare play when they make it.
No, trims.
Added stuff. Added his own couplets, his own iambic pentameter.
Look, Julian Fellowes can do whatever he wants.
I'm Julian Fellowes.
That's right.
Julian Fellowes, Shakespeare planner.
He can do whatever he wants, and nobody apparently in England can tell him no. Oh, you want to just jazz up Shakespeare? Go right ahead. I think the thing about Shakespeare stuff now, though, is that at this point, everybody has done so many crazy things to Shakespeare that no one really cares anymore if you are subtracting or adding or hip-hopizing or...
But
you know, Baz Luhrmanning,
but say what you will about Luhrmann, at least he left the text alone.
Did he?
Yeah.
Did he?
I mean, he
do we know?
He cut things out, which almost everybody does when they're making a Shakespeare play into a movie, but he didn't.
Are we sure he didn't add actual, lyrics by Scritti Politti into the...
He did not.
into the actual dialogue.
He just included, "Everybody's free." all right. But do listen to this week's B-Movies podcast. It was fun to do with Bibbs and Whitney. But it was fun to enjoy, and it will be fun to enjoy for you to listen to. That's our other inside joke, I guess, now. Okay. So you want to go right into the... We got to go.
We got to get right into it.
Captain,
we got like 30 minutes.
Captain Phillips.
Is good.
It is. it's Paul Greengrass, who you know from United 93 and Bloody Sunday and the second and third Bourne movies.
You know, he's from United 93.
a movie that I still have issues with. I didn't say anything this week on What the Flick when Ben and Christy kept talking about it. I still find that movie to be borderline emotional pornography.
Yes.
I just think it was
I didn't want to watch it the first time.
For me it was the classic example of too soon. But people disagree with me on it, whatever. That's their problem.
It's a really good movie.
It is well crafted for what it is. I just question its very existence.
It's a really good movie that I never want to see again.
Well, that too. But he brings up, there's a certain vibe of that film, of the way he recreates a real life event as it unfolded that you get in this movie as well, because I mean not as much, but you get not just Tom Hanks on this cargo vessel that's being raided by Somali pirates, but you also get the people in the room with the radar screens who are telling them what to do, and the Navy SEALs who are figuring out how they're going to come in and rescue and do the whole da-da-da.
And the crew hiding in the engine room planning Home Alone-style sabotage.
That's right, putting broken glass on the floor because one of the pirates is barefoot.
Grabbing sticks and throwing things to divert and... Yeah.
Yeah.
I just kept thinking of Home Alone. Every time someone... Here's the thing.
Quick, fill the paint cans.
Whenever... Back when I was a volunteer at Aid Services of Dallas back in the early 90s, I was driving those little kids that lived there to the movies every Saturday.
Right.
They loved Home Alone a lot.
I'm sure.
Because it was that era.
Yeah.
And I believe we saw Home Alone 2 or 3. I can't remember now which one it was.
Two is Lost in New York. Three is not Macaulay Culkin.
Whatever it was. Saw one of them, and every time the kid would do the thing to sabotage a bad guy, the kids that I was with would go, Home Alone!
It's like, ooh, there's this is where Die Hard comes through the window.
It's specifically, it's like Bebe's Kids, where the Robin Harris bit about Bebe's Kids, where every time something horrible would happen, the kids would go, "Small World!" Because they're on the Small World ride, wreaking havoc. And then when we went to see Richie Rich, and Macaulay Culkin was in Richie Rich, the little ones would be like, "Home Alone!"
And that is why Macaulay Culkin is semi-reclusive now. Because for the rest of his life, he's going to be Home Alone! Just imagine a screening of Party Monster.
As the guys were sabotaging the Somali pirates, I sat there thinking, "Home Alone!"
I'm sure that's what Paul Greengrass wanted you to feel. So yeah, so it's based on the book by Captain Phillips. So spoiler, he lives. I think it's super intense. I mean, it's very, yes, it very suspenseful. And I always think it's amazing when you can make a suspenseful movie about a historical event whose outcome we know.
Yeah.
My go-to on that one is Apollo 13, also starring Tom Hanks, now I realize, where, you know, we knew that it landed, but still the whole time, how are they going to, what is it, I like this movie a lot, and I think Tom Hanks gives his, you know, one of his best performances in a while, if not ever.
It really is. He's really, really good.
Yeah.
Very sort of, like, clamped down and stripped down and...
Yeah,
and knowing that you will love him automatically from the get go, even though he's kind of a stern taskmaster, man of few words.
Right, coffee breaks over.
You bring your love of Tom Hanks to that, and so when he walks in to the room where the guys are on their coffee break, and he's like, 15 minutes, coffee's done. Drink your coffee." You're like, "I love Tom Hanks." Meanwhile, if you were that guy sitting in the coffee room, you'd be like, "Dick, you would not want to be or his crew."
That guy. My one drawback on this, and tell me if you agree, I kind of felt like that there were times where, I mean, yes, the Somali pirates are the bad guys. I'm not trying to claim that they wouldn't be, because, you know. But there were shots of the film where I felt they were either presented as these sort of kind of bug-eyed monsters, or their eyes were completely hidden in shadow, and it dehumanized them.
I don't think so.
I mean, there are moments in the film, there are other moments where they sort of give them some context and explain why they kind of have little choice but to do this because their fishing lanes have been over, you know, fished and blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying that Greengrass is out to demonize them.
They're essentially forced to go do this.
You're right, exactly. But
it's shown at the beginning of the movie that the guy's like, "All right, I need four of you. You. And then they're like, come on, get in the boat.
I get that. But once the thing is in progress and they're on the big boat with Tom Hanks and stuff, and then later when they're in the lifeboat, I kind of felt like the movie just sort of turns them into these sort of kind of cartoony monsters, and you lose any sense of their humanity. That was my takeaway. I don't know if you agree.
Well, the hyperactivity is all about that cot they're chewing.
Well, exactly, yeah.
Like they're all hopped they're up all, on that plant. Yeah,
they're all cocaine, drugged up on
that cocaine plant that they all chew. And so that, I mean, they mentioned that cot like three times in the movie. And so
they've been drinking green tea all day.
Exactly. So it's I think the film does as good a job explaining them as it does of explaining Tom Hanks. The thing is, though, that about them is what they bring with them is a very sort of a horror movie presence. Mm-hmm. Because A, they're the bad guys.
Right.
B, they're skeletal dudes because they're starving.
Right.
And so that makes their eyes bug out even more because their eyes are popping out of their skulls because they don't have any body fat on themselves. Right. And they're screaming in another language that sounds angry every single time. It's like German. Everything sounds like you're mad.
Right.
You know? And so there are it's not dealt with narratively, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all these little sort of signifying,
right,
sort of ruptures in your comfort, and you accept them as these people who could do anything, kill anybody at any moment, and who are pretty much just on drugs right now. And forced against their will, knowing that they're probably going to be killed if they don't bring back some money.
Right, right.
So it's this, everything is amped up and everything is tense and everything is horrible. Here's what I really kind of liked about the movie. I like Paul Greengrass's ability to pull back and to be almost, as in the words of Bibbs, almost clinical. Because that's a word Heath used when we were walking out of the screening. And he doesn't give you a lot. And what that means is that you can read this movie in a lot of different ways. Uh-huh. You can see it as, oh, they've infantilized and dehumanized the bad guys, or you know, or he's amped up the military narrative, you know,
right?
Because there's this definite, now that we're out of the Iraq War more or less, and on our way out of Afghanistan, the movies, it seems, are shifting response wise to this. I think during the Iraq War, the military narrative in Hollywood film was despair and hopelessness. And now we've got like Zero Dark Thirty and this and that Navy SEALs movie that came out last year, where
Act of Valor.
Doesn't matter how good it is. I'm not
I understand your point.
I'm not talking about how good they are. I'm talking about there's now a narrative of assurance, reassurance.
Hmm.
The military is going to come and they're going to get them.
Hmm.
And that's what happened in this story.
Yes.
The Navy came in their gigantic ship and was like, all right, just step away from the Captain Phillips, because we're here to take care of it and you're ours now.
Right.
And I said in my review, a really striking moment for me was the scene where the camera follows the cord all the way up from little lifeboat that's being towed by the gigantic Navy ship.
Hmm.
And the music swells really dramatically and sadly in that moment. And what you get is this idea that these two things are connected, and they will always be connected, and it is fixed, and it is hopeless. And it is hopeless for the people in the lifeboat, with the exception of Captain Phillips,
right,
who is going to be put back onto the Navy ship where he belongs,
right,
and the rest of y'all who have attempted to rob and steal and murder from us, y'all are going to get killed.
Hmm.
That's what it's going to be. And so don't step up again, because we're going to crush you always.
I will grant that Greengrass is artist enough that his films are open to interpretation.
Right.
That's just the one that I left with.
So you can read it like that as this sort of like giant thing against this tiny thing.
Yeah.
But again, he gives you with that. And I've, now, since I've written mine, I've seen other reviews that hate this movie because they feel like it's a fantasy about American military might, when it's not a fantasy at all. It's a reality.
It actually happened, yeah.
And sort of like a rah-rah for the military. Well, it's weird.
It's interesting, but just because we've been talking about this movie in the context of Gravity and about next week's All Is Lost with Robert Redford, and without getting into too much into spoilers, I will say that in the other two films are more about people who are who have to be self-reliant in a crisis situation, whereas this one is more about the, you know, the cavalry literally riding in to the rescue. You know?
Yes.
Well, all right.
Figuratively,
yes. Okay, yes. Fine. They're swimming into the rescue, whatever they are. But they are the cavalry, basically. Okay. This week also we get Machete Kills, which is boring. How do you make a goofy exploitation movie boring?
It's meant to be funny. It's meant to be gory. It's meant to be exciting. It's meant to take your breath away
and be outrageous.
In the way that Piranha 3D was. I always come back to that because that's the movie that I left feeling excited and happy and grossed out all at the same time. And it's how I felt when I watched Grindhouse
exactly
the first time. And it's how I felt watching those fake trailers in the middle of the two movies that were part of Grindhouse.
Right.
And when I saw the trailer from Machete, I was like, I'll watch that movie. I know it's fake, but I'll watch that movie. I'll watch Don't. I'll watch Thanksgiving. I'll watch, you know, all of it.
Werewolf Women of the SS.
Yes, I'd watch all of those movies. And when the first Machete came along, I was like, okay, it doesn't quite live up to the trailer's promise of mayhem, but I'm happy enough.
It's just enough fun to...
And this is just more of the same, sort of like a blown-up, distended, not as funny, not as radical, not as crazy version. And there are crazier ideas. You know, there's a cannibal hooker in this movie. There's a machine. There's a ray gun that turns you inside out. There's a, you know, the promise of Machete grabbing onto a rocket and being shot up into space. And when he grabbed the rocket, I thought, don't let go, Machete.
You know, this is a real disappointment. I watching it, I was reminded of how I felt watching the fourth Spy Kids movie.
Yeah.
Where it's like, boy, okay, this started out as a fun thing, and you have just run out of ideas, and you're still making the movie.
This is definitely a running on low energy kind of film.
And he didn't even write it. Some other guy.
It's like he took a lot of naps and weed breaks, and I don't know if he smokes weed, but you know. It's like something was he was somehow sort of half checked out of this one, and it made me wish for Machete Kills Again in Space, which is the fake trailer that brackets the beginning and end.
Well, it's at the beginning, and then the whole movie works its way to be a jumping off point for that movie. But by the end of this movie, I was like, oh God, no more. No more sequels.
I will be happy with Machete Kills Again in Space if they will return to the Grindhouse aesthetic, which, here's the thing, you're watching that trailer at the beginning and it's scratchy and grainy and skips and pops like a record and looks like someone pulled it out of the projection and put it on the floor and walked on it. And then you go into Machete Kills, and it's this clean, digital, bright movie of 2013 that looks just like an empty, shiny box of nothing.
Yeah.
Go back and make it that Grindhouse style. Do it the way Planet Terror was with the missing reel.
Right, and the pops.
Do that. That's fun. And I, even if it's fake, it's fun. I enjoy that, you know, fakery.
Yeah.
But I'm not.
But more than that, you have to. If you're just going to be outrageous and nothing but adrenaline, then there better be adrenaline. There better be something moving this thing from scene to scene, from crazy thing to keep you interested. This just sort of feels like this random assortment of, well, then we can do this and.
And it's almost that. 2 hours long.
Yes,
it's an hour and 45, hour and 50 minutes,
something
long.
Like that. Yeah,
it's a stupid amount of time. This is an 85-minute movie.
Absolutely.
You have no legal right to make a movie longer than 85 minutes if it is Machete Kills.
Yes.
It's just not right.
No.
It needs to be short and kick-ass and to the point. It is, I'll quote my movies.com review, it is reluctant where it should be raw.
Yeah. That's a fair cop. And the big name actors are giving sort of winkingly bad performances. Yeah,
all of them.
I think Sofia Vergara is actually bad in this. I think she's
given nothing to do but be
right. Exactly, but
it works really well on Modern Family.
Yeah, she needs to find some notes within that. Like am I at 3 in this scene or am I at 8? She's always at 12. You know.
Yeah.
So I just was really disappointed. There's one kind of funny idea. Well, there's a couple of funny ideas, but one of them is there's an assassin who's a master of disguise, which basically gives Rodriguez the excuse to put all these different celebrities in cameos because the
Antonio
assassin
Banderas
keeps taking the mask off and turns into somebody else.
Walter Goggins, Walton Goggins Justified.
Lady Gaga,
and
Cuba Gooding Jr.
They're all one character.
Yeah.
And that's fun. But it's kind of a bummer where I'm watching Lady Gaga in a movie thinking, I wish there were more of her. I wish there was more Lady Gaga because she seems like she's having a good time and she's got the tone right for herself.
True, you know? Yes. The big letdown.
Yeah.
Big letdown.
It is a bummer.
God Loves Uganda opens in New York this week, but Dave's going to see it by next week's show, and we're going to talk about it for its L.A. opening next weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It was the documentary centerpiece at Outfest this summer.
Yeah.
And then you saw...
two things yesterday.
Oh, right. Yeah, so you did.
Yeah.
That I did not, so go for it.
I saw Jia Zhengke. I can't pronounce the guy's name. I saw his latest movie yesterday. It opened Friday. It's called A Touch of Sin. Apparently, sort of a play on an earlier film that I have not seen, but now I need to.
Mm.
Called A Touch of Zen.
By him?
No.
Oh.
Like a martial arts film.
Mm.
Even though this is not a martial arts film.
Hmm.
There's a bit of a nod to martial arts in one section of the film. But each segment of this movie, it's a four stories. And one sort of bleeds into the next. Not in a terrible babble or crash sort of way where, you know, we're all in this together.
All interconnected.
If you want to reduce it to that, you could, but you would be wrong. Now, Jia Zhengke has made some really, really terrific, great, wonderful films in the past 10 years. Platform, Still Life, The World, Unknown Pleasures, and some others off the top of my head. I'm just not getting all of them. This may be the best thing he's done.
Hmm, okay.
Because
to be honest, I couldn't get through The World.
There are people out there who are already saying this is his masterpiece.
Huh, okay.
And if you are interested in, you know, films from the other world countries, and if you're not, I want you to stop listening to this show forever and go away because you're not my friend. You're not a friend of this podcast.
No, you need to be encouraging.
I encourage you to watch this film.
To watch films from other
countries. Or never listen to us again.
From other lands.
From other lands, yeah. Because you're part of the problem. If you won't read subtitles, you're part of the problem. And we're not friends. Yeah. Anyway, so this movie's great. And it's four stories, each one of them about how pretty much everything is screwed up in China right now.
Uh-huh.
and it begins with a guy who is sort of he's like a whistleblower,
mm-hmm.
who becomes a vigilante. There are people who are selling off collectively owned property in this little village. And one man is getting incredibly rich from it. And, like, he has a private plane.
Hmm.
And everybody else has just sort of decided, well, okay, he works really hard. So, of course, he has a private plane. We're all going to go out and greet him when he arrives in the village in his private plane and give him flowers and sort of treat him like this visiting dignitary when he's really just a CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the guy goes up, he's an actor, Lu Zhang, or Wu Zhang, I think is the actor's name. He's been in a bunch of stuff in China. I'm probably ruining his name and getting it wrong. I'll have to go back and look at that. He walks right up to the CEO and he's like, I would like to file a formal complaint against you for corruption. Everyone's like, arrest that man. Get him out of my way, you know. And then he gets a rifle.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So it's his story bleeds into one about a criminal who does a lot of stealing and robbing.
Wu Zhang,
yeah. The next one is about a woman who works in a sauna who is having an affair and her descent into... sort of a destitute existence. And the last one is about a young boy who goes to work in a factory and then has to leave to go to another factory that is called the Oasis of Prosperity.
Oh, boy.
There are weird touches of humor in this film, but it really is about the inherent violence in contemporary life in China, both specifically economically, the sort of economic injustice and violence that's being perpetrated on the vast majority of Chinese population. Parallels to the American population are entirely appropriate. And who are, in turn, become involved in real violence. It's so great, I want to see it again. It is. I'm not going to be reviewing it for movies.com. I will be reviewing it for linoleum-knife.com this week. But if I were going to star rating it on movies.com, mm-hmm. this would be another 5.
Wow.
It's incredible.
Now, does he get in trouble in China? Is he one of those filmmakers?
I don't know. If he doesn't, I'm surprised.
Huh. Interesting.
He might get in trouble on this one. Because it does not have a lot of nice things to say about the people in power.
Gotcha. Okay, I'll have to check it out. And then you also went to Red Cat last night, the Roy and Edna Disney Cal Arts Theater. It's in the Disney Hall where they do performance stuff and film and whatever, and you went to a film thing.
Yeah, my friend Dennis and I went to see Henri-Georges Clouzot's
Inspector Clouzot
1960 movie with Brigitte Bardot. Mm. It's called La Vérité.
Clouzot is probably best known for he made Wages of Fear.
And Diabolique. Yes.
And there's a really cool documentary, I think it's called Inferno, about this film that he never finished with Romy Schneider, I want to say. It came out a couple years ago. It was really fascinating. One of those portraits of a movie that never got done because just everything spiraled out of control, yeah. Kind of thing.
This is a really, really, really incredible film that apparently is not widely available.
I've never heard of it until this
barely screened. Barely screened in the United States. Like, I think the woman from the French cultural thing last night, mm-hmm. at the Red Cat said that it was screened 3 years ago at a Harvard retrospective of Clouzot's work. And then before that, she has no
record
of it being screened, like, anywhere.
Wow.
And this was a beautiful, perfect 35mm print.
Oh, nice.
And what's fascinating about this movie is that it came out in 1960, which is the same year as Breathless, year after the 400 blows.
Mm-hmm.
So what you get is...
And when year after And God Created Woman, right? If we're talking about Bardot.
Maybe, yeah. What you get is... I don't remember what year...
I'm looking it up. Go ahead.
What you get is this old-fashioned, formally conservative director sort of sliding...
56.
Sliding into youth culture.
Oh, that's always a treat.
And the entire movie is sort of about how parents just don't understand. I mean, it's a courtroom drama based on an alleged crime of passion. We are to understand that Brigitte Bardot has murdered her genius composer, who's very young, fiancé, in a crime of passion, because he is going to marry her sister instead. And it really becomes, as the movie unfolds, it really becomes the idea of kids just being on trial. Because you've got this entire generation that are now creating the Nouvelle Vague, who are breaking radically, stylistically, formally from the past, creating new forms of narrative and new forms of storytelling and new ideas of how film should be, and not just film, but life.
Mm-hmm.
Jacques Jean-Luc Godard. Yeah, it's very much a sort of like someone walking up to Marlon Brando in a leather jacket and saying, "What are you rebelling against?" And him saying, "What do you got?" It's very much this kind of movie. She slouches on the stand. Her hair's all teased up. She's, you know, a party girl who you know, has sex with all these different guys, and but she's super in love with him still. And the adults, the lawyers, and the spectators, and the jury, they don't get this girl who can't even articulate her own ideas about life. Who simply says things like, "None of you have ever loved. You're all dead." And you see a kid say something like that, and you're like, "Sure, sure, move along." You know.
Talk to me in 10 years.
Right. And so it's a really, really fascinating, you know, snapshot of
the teenage explosion.
The 60s becoming the 60s.
Right.
Of youth culture becoming the dominant force and unseating the oldsters. And the response of film to that, the response of specifically French cinema, and how, you know, the papa is sort of left behind as the new wave
right.
kicks in.
I mean, Clouseau is not really considered a new wave
no.
guy at
no,
all.
No. He's
oh,
not.
Oh, he's making this against them.
Not ag- maybe not even against them. I don't know if he was against them or not.
Okay.
But it was definitely his version of... of, well, I'm gonna. This is gonna be a film about young people, and what are we to do with them? You know, how are we to judge them? And so let's literally make it a courtroom drama.
Judge away.
Yeah, and so yeah, it's great. It's got so many different like layers of meaning and readability going on. It's just. Such a great thing.
Oh, cool. What's it called again?
La Vérité.
Mm.
The Truth.
The Truth.
It's on YouTube if you want to check it out.
Okay, yeah. We'll post a link on the Facebook page. Yeah, no, I only ask about being against the Nouvelle Vague because I did a Q&A once at the USA Film Festival with Claude Lelouch. And, you know, while they were all running around being experimental, he was making A Man and a Woman. And he was like, screw these guys. I'm going to tell a story.
right. No, this has, like I said, formally, this is a conventional narrative film.
Okay.
There's nothing Nouvelle Vague about this.
Gotcha.
It is. And in fact, it
it's goes trad, Dad.
It goes more in the direction of And God Created Woman than, for example, in the direction of Contempt. Because God Created Woman, you've got Bardot presented as, you know, object of desire.
Right.
She is sex kitten.
Mm.
And in this movie, although it's not as va-va-voom as that, you know, you see her butt, you know, 1960, you see her naked butt, and you see her like
derriere,
humping a bed and dancing while dance humping a bed. I called it proto twerking in a Facebook post this morning. It's definitely more interested in her as both an object of voluptuous desire and an object of confusion.
Hmm.
Because she represents the kids and she represents this brazen attitude among the kids, and that's disconcerting.
Well, even in And God Created Woman, I think she's sort of presented as this kind of consuming, you know, like woman,
yeah,
you know, devouring everything in her path, you know.
Well, you see her in Contempt, and she's sort of like just an object as an object.
Right.
She's not a, hey,
no,
you
no,
know.
No.
The camera's not lusting for her
yeah.
in Contempt.
She is an anchor on whatever man is unfortunate enough to be bewitched by her, basically.
So... yeah, and it's such a good movie that it makes you forget that Brigitte Bardot grew up to be a super cranky right-wing, white power-ish...
animal rights lunatic.
Animal rights anti-gay lunatic.
Muslim-hating.
Yeah. She's a big geriatric mess right now. But, you know, back in the day, she was a thing to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no question.
And she reminds me of Jill, our next door neighbor Jill, so much. Every time I look at young Brigitte Bardot, I'm like, "You look like my neighbor Jill,
super foxy Jill.
You look like Jill. We've got that face, that sort of like, I've just been in bed.
Mm.
That is my face. I've been in bed with romantic things happening to me and my hair.
And now I'm wearing a man's shirt with sleeves right. rolled up.
Yes.
Give me a cigarette. Okay. What's your DVD pick this week?
I got one. We're in a hurry.
Really?
Yeah, I forgot.
All right, mine is.
I was in such a planning state this morning of like, okay, we're gonna do this and this and this, and I gotta get my jacket ready.
Mine is Grindhouse because Machete Kills reminded me how it was everything that it was not doing anything giving me any of the pleasure that Grindhouse did. I love Grindhouse. I think as homages to older forms of film go. It's great. You know, I wish Stanley Donen's movie were available on DVD, but it's not.
Right.
Actually, the two films are very similar because they're both double features of, you know, an earlier era's form of films. The Donen one, it's like half black and white boxing melodrama and half sort of color Busby Berkeley musical. And then, you know, Grindhouse is, you know, the Rodriguez movie, Planet Terror, and Tarantino's Death Proof. You've probably seen it, but I'm going to recommend it anyway.
I'll pick an old Gia Genke movie for my DVD. Whatever's available, I'll go find it out. We'll put it on the Facebook page.
Still, well, let's say Still Life. How about that?
Sure!
Still Life. Boom.
All right, we have time for a letter.
Okay.
And it is a subject that we have discussed many, many times. Well, here's the letter. This is from Julian of That Cinema... No, not that. Of The Cinema Touch. Mm. The Cinema Touch. Dear Mr. Giraldi and Mr. White.
Keep it formal.
It's Julian from The Cinema Touch again. I'm still loving every bit of the podcast. Thank you, Julian. Just a quick question. I know it's a running joke that Mr. Giraldi has a strong disdain for Pulp Fiction, but I don't believe he has ever articulated why on the podcast. So,
haven't I?
Here's the thing. I think that you have. My memory is, and maybe it's just because I've lived with you for 18 years, but my memory is that you have talked about why you hate Pulp Fiction on this show, maybe even more than once.
I'm thinking I have too.
But for the sake of new folks and for Julian, give us a quick version why you are the Pulp Fiction naysayer
right.
mm-hmm. of everybody.
I know. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that Machete Kills had no right to be, you know, 110 minutes. I remember at the time our friend Robert Abley saying, there's no reason a movie called Pulp Fiction should be longer than 2 hours. I have several beefs with the film. I think that this was early on in Tarantino's career. He had a tendency to write movies where all the characters sound like Quentin Tarantino.
And how?
I think when I reviewed it at the time for a little magazine called Planet Homo, I said that it's like watching a puppet show where Tarantino has all the socks.
Here's what I love about you and Planet Homo. Planet Homo was the little free newspaper that they used to give out in the gay bars in Dallas.
No,
not in Dallas, in Los Angeles in the early 90s when you lived here.
Right.
I've never seen an issue of Planet Homo in real life other than the stack that you still have in your
archives.
In your archive. I love that the Los Angeles Film Critics Association voted you in on the strength of your reviews in Planet Homo.
It was so much easier to get in back then. It was pre-internet. And also,
my
reviews for Planet Homo were awesome.
I want to know that Richard Schickel.
He probably didn't show up at that meeting.
Sat in on that and by all means.
He probably was not even there.
Let's let this young man in. This gay is a voice that we need.
Anyway, I think the movie is really badly paced. I think, you know, he had not quite nailed that aspect of it. And that's even an issue, I think, to some extent, but less so with Reservoir Dogs, but especially with Pulp Fiction. I think it drags out in places. There's not a really good rhythm to the film. I feel like it coasts too much on the idea of things rather than actually doing them. We're supposed to get that the idea of a dance number with John Travolta is cool because of John Travolta's history on film, but the dance scene itself isn't shot all that well. It coasts on our collective memory of John Travolta's film career up to that point. I don't know. I don't even remember now. It's been a long time since I've seen it. It's just a movie that's always left me cold. I think it's too impressed with itself. I think it's a movie that's too easy to read things into, but that doesn't really deliver. And I think that he has gotten much better as a filmmaker since then.
And I think you're wrong.
Well,
and so does everybody else.
Not the Baffler.
Whatevs. That's what I have to say to you and the Baffler. That's my measured, thoughtful response to both of you. Whatevs.
Well, yeah, and obviously my disdain for Pulp Fiction has clearly stood in its way of becoming a beloved contemporary classic. Yeah. So, you know, that and
Why have you decided to hold back Pulp Fiction from its rightful spot in film history?
That and The Shawshank Redemption. Clearly, I have thrown my body down in front of them and kept them from going any further.
You've been the human shield.
That's right.
To making sure those movies never get seen or talked about or loved by anyone.
Yes, I have that
kind of... Hope you're happy with yourself.
I have that kind of power. All right, are we done? Are we moving on? We have an opera.
We're done. We got to go to the opera.
Okay, so once again, do check out this week's B-Movies podcast. It was lovely to have a chance to be on the show again. I'm now their reigning champion of guest hosts, by the way.
Nice. So
take that. Nice. Check out our friends out there, ChristyLemire.com. Check out Rotten Tomatoes Radio with Matt Atchity and Gray Drake. Check out the Frank DeCaro Show on Sirius XM Radio and Derek and Romain. The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli is back. Team Jack, The Lunch, you know, the usual folks. We always tell you this. I don't have it in front of me. Have a good week. We promise a longer show next time. There will be so much more to talk about.
And you know what? We don't promise a longer show next time.
No, we are doing.
We promise that you'll get as much of us as we decide to give. We run things. Things don't run we.
There are a lot of movies over next week, so I can guarantee it will be a longer show. Anyway, thanks for checking us out, and we will catch you. Oh, visit linoleum-knife.com. We will be updating it with new stuff this week, including Dave's review.
We promise.
Longer review of the thing, and I've got stuff that I'm going to be doing. And yeah, I know. We've been a little slack, but we're going to get on.
Not slack. Busy with other stuff.
Well,
things get in the way.
Specifically, because we've been doing other things.
Okay. Again, no apologies. Anyway. You're lucky to know us.
You're lucky to be alive.
That's right.
All right. We'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.